This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that changed exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachi.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.
You're about to listen to a brand new series of Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley. Episodes will be released weekly wherever you get your podcasts. But if you can't wait, head over to BBC Sounds where you can listen to the latest episodes a whole week earlier, first on BBC Sounds. If you'd like to stay up to date with the latest episodes, make sure you subscribe to Lady Killers on the BBC Sounds app and have push notifications switched on.
Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, from BBC Radio 4. We are back for a brand new series. It's Lady Killers, but not as you know it. In this episode, we've got a special treat for you. It's true crime meets family history, with a twist.
I've got a Victorian lady killer in my family.
Intrigued? So are we. So we've decided to bring you Lady Killer in My Family. And it's a really fascinating case.
Dear Father, I cannot stand this life any longer. I am treated like dirt. I am the eldest and think I am the right one to look after the little ones. I have not known what it is to have a home since Mother died.
Amelia was rather upset on Wednesday. She went out and returned with a bottle, which she placed on the corner of the dresser. Shortly after 2 o'clock, I heard high words and much running about in the house. I could distinguish Lizzie's voice, and it seemed as if there was quarrelling between the two sisters.
I have to warn you, this episode contains references to suicide. Join me for this brand new case where my all-female team of detectives set off on another historical adventure. We're going to revisit the unthinkable crimes committed by murderesses more than 100 years ago. This time, a tragedy involving murder and suicide, a mystery that shrouds a family burial, and a Lady Killers fan who wants to know more about a dark family secret. This is an investigation with a difference, and it all started with an email from listener Charlotte Godfrey, who wants to find out about her great-great-aunt's role in the Chertsey murder of 1894. I gave Charlotte a call to find out more. Hello, Charlotte.
Hello, Lucy.
I hear that you're a Lady Killers listener and that you've got a mystery for us to solve. Why did you message in?
I've been listening to the show since the start and I absolutely love it. And so my nan was called Daisy and she told my dad quite late in her life that her aunt had murdered another aunt. Like two sisters, one a lot older than the other one. And then she took her own life as well. So it's pretty sad.
So you have learnt from your dad that one of your great-great-aunts killed another of your great-great-aunts and then took her own life.
Yeah, it's crazy to think that's in my actual family.
So Charlotte, what's motivated you to find out more about this amazing story in your family?
I think I would like to find out the set of circumstances in which one sister could do that to her younger sister. As somebody with three younger sisters myself, I empathise with being in the position of older sister. And I would like to be able to have more information to be able to say to people, a very sad thing happened, a very tragic thing happened, rather than my great-great-aunt killed her sister in cold blood.
So you're feeling quite compassionate towards the people involved.
Yeah, there but for the grace, right? So if I had been born 130 years earlier, with a large family, had something happened to us, what would have been the difference in the way we were supported or not supported?
It's always interesting finding out about how mental health, mental illness were treated in the past, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, thanks for trusting us with this mystery, Charlotte. I can't wait to get started. I know just the person to help with your inquiries. That's going to be our in-house historian, Rosalind Crone. She loves doing stuff like this.
Brilliant, thank you.
Hello, Charlotte. It's really lovely to meet you in the flesh. Thanks for coming into Lady Killers HQ.
Hi, thank you so much for looking into this case.
It's a pleasure. I'm also joined by Professor Rosalind Crone, our in-house historian. Hello, Ros.
Hello, Lucy. And hello, Charlotte.
Now, you two have already met each other, but more of that later. OK, let's recap. Here's what we know so far. This story centres on the Hazlitt family, who lived in Chertsey in Surrey in the late 19th century. Can you tell us a bit more about them?
So let's start with the parents. We have William Hazlitt, a bricklayer, who marries Eliza Jane Doe in 1875. The couple moved to the parish of Addleston, to a place called Hare Hill. They went on to have five children, Ella Amelia, who we're calling Amelia, the eldest, next Harry, Eliza, called Lizzie, George, and Martha, the youngest, who the family call Daisy. Now, in 1888, the mother, Eliza, dies. She's only 37. And local reports say that Amelia stepped up and took on some of the responsibilities that her mother would have had. By 1894, Amelia has moved out of the family home, and we know she is working in domestic service.
And Ros, do we know if the place where the crime actually happened still exists?
Well, I did a bit of investigation. The crime happened in the family home, so Charlotte and I met up in Addleston to find out more. Hello, Charlotte.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Oh, it's lovely to meet you. And thank you for joining me here in this beautiful clearing. Just behind that row of trees there, we see a line of houses. And that's why I've brought you here, because we think that the Hazlitt family lived in this road, in this little cluster of houses here.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Now, I've brought with me a copy of the Ordnance Survey map from the 1890s. We know from the inquest records that the Hazlitt family lived in one of Gray's cottages on Hare Hill. So you see behind the cottages, we have the brick field. And of course, William Hazlitt was a bricklayer. He would have worked in this brick field. And I've also brought with me a copy of the 1891 census. So if we run down here, we see William Hazlitt. Now, that was your great-great-grandfather.
Yep.
Right, good. And Mary Hazlitt, William Hazlitt's mother, she's moved into the house. And she calls herself the housekeeper. In this time, when men became widowers, they really struggled to match up childcare with the need to go out and earn money. So it was very common to bring in a female relative to help look after the children. And you might have noticed at this time that Amelia is not here.
No.
So already she has moved out.
So they'd have been grieving, but they had each other. And it was obviously difficult for Amelia being outside of it as well.
I think it was very difficult for her being sent away from the family unit.
Yeah.
I think it could have been a big wrench.
So, obviously, I know where the story ends up. I don't know about their lives. I imagined that their lives were quite grim. But actually, looking at this field, in the sunshine, all the open space on the map, it makes me feel that although Daisy had a short life, it might have been quite happy. And that is reassuring for me, and it will be nice for my family as well.
Charlotte, welcome back to the studio. How was that?
I left Hare Hill feeling that things were not as grim as I had imagined them in my head. I'd imagined a lot of people living in a tiny house, doing manual labour and not having their mother, and that all being quite dark and dirty. But actually, it's in the countryside and they seem to have a nice community around them.
There's a special thrill that you get from walking in the actual footsteps of people who've gone before us, I think. Did you feel that?
Yeah, definitely where we were standing is where they might have played on happier days.
Of course. Let's get back to the case. Charlotte, we've also been able to find out more about the days before the murder. This is from court testimony and first-hand accounts. We're going to let Amelia's aunt, Emma Thomas, take up the story.
Alas, saw my niece on Saturday afternoon. She had been in service until the previous Monday when she went into lodgings in Kilburn Park Road. I wrote to her father complaining that Amelia was keeping fast company and that she wanted to borrow money from her brother Harry. I told Harry not to give her money as she shouldn't be in lodgings.
So it seems that Amelia doesn't initially come back to the family home and is maybe looking for a way to pay for her lodgings elsewhere. What do you think, Charlotte, about Amelia keeping fast company, as her aunt describes it?
I mean, I'm sort of proud of her for that. This sounds like my kind of girl. I feel like there's a kinship because I'm the oldest of a lot of sisters. And I know that when I went away to university and so was first off the leash, maybe I kept some fast company. Maybe that's how we'll describe it.
Strange parallels here, Charlotte. Was what happens next?
Well, Amelia does write to her brother, Harry. He's 17 years old at this point. She asks him to lend her 6 shillings, but he writes back and refuses to do so. So Amelia sends him another letter.
Your letter to hand. I shall not bother you anymore. I shall do as I please and not ask anyone. I'm leaving tomorrow, but I'm not going to live in Kilburn. No one need bother themselves about me, for you will never find me. I shan't want to see you again.
We know that by this time Amelia has moved back home on about Sunday the 12th of May. And through newspaper records, we know something about the next few days. There's a strange atmosphere in the household. Despite the tension, there's no sign that Amelia is distressed in the run-up to the murder. But a quarrel between her and her younger sister Lizzie seems to change all that.
Amelia was rather upset on Wednesday. She went out and returned with a bottle, which she placed on the corner of the dresser.
That bottle contains deadly poison, carbolic acid, bought from the chemist round the corner at Devonshire Terrace. That evening, Amelia takes little Daisy upstairs and gives her a drink containing the carbolic acid. Police later find some sugar in the room and they guess that Amelia sweetens the acid before giving it to young Daisy. Amelia then drinks some of it herself. Minutes later, both girls are found very, very ill. 18-year-old Amelia, the perpetrator, dies almost instantly. And Daisy, who's just 9, dies 2 hours later. Charlotte, that's impossibly sad. What are you thinking at this moment?
It feels desperate and it feels the product of frustration and it's horrible. My sisters annoy the hell out of me, but I couldn't be without them. I can't even begin to imagine, especially since they'd already lost their mother. But the pain that Amelia must have felt to do it as well. The whole thing seems really sad.
What almost breaks my heart is the detail of the sugar. It was a thoughtful way of getting it done. Goodness me.
She's 9 years old, so it's not like she's a baby. There would have been an element of trust.
Of course.
She trusted her sister. Well, yeah. I've got this thing for you to drink. Oh, isn't it sweet?
It's truly horrible. Now, Charlotte, one of the questions you had is where these two sisters, your great-great-aunts, are buried. Roz, over to you.
Yes, well, when we were in Surrey, that's where Charlotte and I headed next. Hello again, Charlotte.
Hey.
Thanks for joining me here. Now, we've come to St Paul's Church in Addlestone, near Chertsey, because this is where your great-great-aunt's story tragically ends. Have you ever been here before?
No, I haven't, and I'm really interested to find out why we're here.
Shall we go in?
Yeah.
Well, Charlotte, we've come inside the church now. We're here because it's part of your family's story, isn't that right?
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, this is where they came to worship, and the funeral was also held here as well.
Yes, you're right. So we've done a little bit of digging and I've been able to pull out some local newspaper reports. They had their funerals here on the 19th of May, 1894. So that was only 3 days after their deaths. So it happened very, very quickly. The funeral is held in the evening, and according to one newspaper, hundreds of people turned up for it. I think it's fair to assume that there would have been a lot of interest in the community. And so it probably would have been a packed church.
Okay.
Yeah. We also know that each girl is placed in a plain elm coffin and that these were carried into the church by men who worked in the brickyard. I have managed to dig out the burial register for the parish. If you can see here at the top, we have Martha Hazlitt, so Daisy, when buried 19th of May, 1894, 9.5 years old.
The half is heartbreaking.
Isn't it just? Yeah, yeah. And Ella Amelia, so Amelia Hazlitt, also buried the same day, 19th of May, 1894, 18 years old.
Yeah, still a baby herself.
Yeah. And we see that the minister of the service was the Reverend Charles Sharp. So you can imagine he would have buried the mother when she died and probably also baptised the two youngest children, including Daisy.
There they are, like 3 days after they've passed away, in black and white, and it's just quite stark and there's no context. It's just, yeah, sad.
Right, well, let's go out into the churchyard now and see if we can find their graves.
Okay.
Well, Charlotte, we think this is probably where the sisters were buried.
Yeah, that is definitely the way the story has been passed down, in that they were both buried here, next to each other, side by side, next to the mother's grave.
Right, well, we don't have a record of plots to refer to, okay. But let's go and have a look at the tombstones that do survive and see what we can find out. Okay, so let's have a look over here. They're quite crumbly, aren't they?
Yeah,
they haven't really stood the test of time. So this is 1865. Oh, this one's a little bit clearer, and it says 1865 as well. So obviously all of these tombstones here are from the 1860s.
Yeah.
So I don't think we're going to find them in this part. I think we're going to struggle.
Okay.
So how about you leave this with me? I'll see if I can work out how they were buried.
Okay.
And let's meet up again in studio and bring Lucy up to speed.
Brilliant.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that change exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Jochi.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.
How did that feel, visiting the church?
It was a bit overwhelming. What really struck me was that it would have been the same vicar who had baptised Daisy. And he'd written in the record that she was 9.5. Like, he was desperate to give her as much as he could, like the extra half.
I can tell that although this is over 100 years ago, this really matters to you, doesn't it?
The more I find out, the more it matters. And the more I sort of want to reach through history and tell them that we remember them. She only had 9.5 years or 18 years, but they're still part of my family. I almost want to hug them and say, it's okay. And actually, generations down the line, we're all okay.
Charlotte, you're giving me a little tear in my eye.
I don't know. When I left and I walked out of the memorial garden that day, the overwhelming feeling was I want them to have a memorial of sorts that isn't just a newspaper headline that says the Chertsey murder. There's more to the story, more to those people. My sisters are the most important people to me. And so I see them as 100-year-old sisters.
So, Roz, have you been able to find out anything more about the circumstances of the burial?
Yes, well, unfortunately, a fire at the church in 2007 destroyed many records, and so we haven't been able to find the exact place of the burial. However, I did manage to find an article about it in the Surrey Advertiser, and that article suggests that the sisters were buried in the same grave and that one or two wreaths were placed on top. And this was very common at the time. Burying family members in the same grave had been common since the medieval period, and even in the 19th century when they tried to stipulate one person per grave, we still know that family members were sometimes buried together.
So what you'd hoped, Charlotte, is true.
It's really reassuring. I hate to think of her being ostracised.
Charlotte, can you predict what your family are going to think about this knowledge that the two sisters are sharing a grave?
I think that it's comforting. My nan was called Daisy, and she always said that she just didn't like the name Daisy. I knew her as Billy her whole life, and it always seemed like an odd story to me and to my sisters. And we used to say to Nan, oh, but it's a really cool name. No, I don't like it. We can only speculate, but I don't imagine it's something Lizzie ever got over. She still wanted to remember her younger sister and to not completely forget the whole event had happened. It stuck with my nan until she passed away. My whole life, nobody ever called her Daisy.
Hmm. Yeah. Apart from you now.
Yeah, I want to shout it from the rooftops. I want to celebrate it.
Now, the inquest was just a few hours before the funerals on Saturday, the 19th of May, 1896. And the verdict was willful murder against Amelia, and that she had committed suicide while of unsound mind. The other question you had for us was, why did Amelia do this thing and what might have been happening with her mental health? To answer this question, we are now joined by Dr. Gwen Adshead, who for many years has been a consultant psychiatrist and psychotherapist at Broadmoor Hospital. Welcome, Gwen.
Hello, Lucy, and hello, Charlotte.
Now, Gwen, we've briefed you on the case and you've had the chance to review all the materials. What are your first thoughts?
What an incredibly sad story this is. It makes me think about the impact of losing your mother when you're a little girl, because Amelia was very young when she lost her mother, and she was also very young to be stepping up into a maternal role. And the fact that that was mentioned, that she became like a kind of mother to the younger children, I think must have been quite stressful for her. And we know that early loss of a mother by bereavement can actually increase your chance of developing depression later on as you get older. And depression, of course, is a kind of mental distress that we often see in people who kill themselves. But of course, the interesting question is why she killed her youngest sister.
Now, to help shed even more light on Amelia's mental state, we can share the suicide note that's found upon her.
Dear Father, I cannot stand this life any longer. I am treated like dirt. I am the eldest and think I am the right one to look after the little ones. I have not known what it is to have a home since Mother died. The children have all been neglected, and no one takes any notice of them. And Daisy is put upon worse than any of them. Forgive me for doing this, but I cannot help it. I will give Daisy a dose, and we shall be out of the way. I have often got things to kill myself, but have put it off. I cannot stand it any longer. From Amelia Hazlitt, aged 18 years old. Goodbye to all my friends and all those that love me.
Oh, Charlotte, that's very hard to hear, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really sad. She's obviously completely at a wit's end and doesn't feel like she's got any options.
Gwen, what do you draw from the suicide note?
Well, what I first draw is the very clear suicidal intention. She's been thinking about killing herself for some time. I wondered whether there was something about her time in service and being away from home that had kind of tipped her into feeling suicidal. Mm. So in my experience, when people kill someone they love, they often try and kill themselves afterwards. That's quite common. And there's a particular kind of story that we see in mothers who kill their children and who then kill themselves afterwards. And those mothers sometimes say that they've killed their children in order to protect them from further suffering. I found myself wondering whether Amelia saw herself really as Daisy's mother, and that ending Daisy's life was a way of protecting her from further harm, as she saw it.
Yes. Do you have any views on the sibling relationships and rivalries within this family?
Amelia had been pushed into a maternal role very early, from the age of 12. And I wondered whether that had actually kind of got in the way of her making very close relationships with her siblings, because she was the one who had to impose authority on them. All of that must have fallen to Amelia at a time when she was grieving for her mother. What she mentions in the suicide note, how she hasn't had a home since her mother died, was very telling.
I think also in the suicide note, it's almost like her thinking is, without the oldest and the youngest, that's less stressful because you've only now got the three kids rather than the five kids.
I also found myself wondering what she wanted the 6 shillings for and what else had been going on in her life. And I did find myself wondering whether she might have been pregnant and whether that was the reason she'd had to leave her job in service and why she needed a plan. Many suicides arise from the sense of psychological pain and desperation and the feeling that if there's no escape, that suicide is the only way out.
Bit of a bombshell, this idea of pregnancy.
Yeah. But I think that there's a gap in the story. Why she leaves her job, doesn't go straight home. Why she's so angry about not being given some money that she writes the horrible letter to her brother that she then regrets.
Yes. Well, Charlotte, you came with questions. Have they been answered?
Yeah, I think so. A lot of the answers are comforting. That sense of community, that sense of kindness, the fact that they had a beautiful neighbourhood and all those things. But it's just still so overwhelmingly sad.
Are you going to go back and talk to your dad and your sisters about what you've learned?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of gaps that have been filled in. And I think the parallels to having a big family, I think it's really striking. And I think we all feel an affinity with Lizzie and Amelia and Daisy, you know, and I think that that will definitely be something we'll be carrying forward and making sure future generations keep that in the family history.
Well, Amelia Hazlitt killed her little sister Daisy and then took her own life. It's a heartbreaking and horrifying act. But as we've discovered on Lady Killers, it's always a bit more complicated than that. Before she came to us, Charlotte had some newspaper headlines and a few half-remembered family stories about her great-great-aunt, but knew very little about her life. She wanted to take a more compassionate look at the situation Amelia found herself in. We hope that by looking more deeply into her family's past, Charlotte's got some understanding and reassurance, I suppose, to pass on to the next generation. Well, a huge thank you to Dr. Gwen Adshead, Professor Rosalind Crone, and Charlotte Godfrey herself. Thanks also to St. Paul's Church, Addleston, the Chertsey Museum, and the Addleston Historical Society. Next time, join me on the rough streets of East London in the 1830s as I investigate the mysterious disappearance of an elderly woman. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley from BBC Radio 4 is produced by Julia Habel. And the readers are Claire Corbett and Ruth Sillers. The executive producer is Kirsty Hunter. And the commissioning editor for BBC Radio 4 is Rhiann Roberts. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can listen first to the episodes if you search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. Now listen, if you've got a case for us featuring a lady killer or a lady swindler in your family, then we'd love to hear from you. Please go to bbc.co.uk/ladykillers or send us an email to ladykillers@bbc.co.uk. Until next time. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Lady Killers. Now, if you like history and know of any budding historians, there's a new podcast that I think you'll enjoy. It's called Dead Funny History, and it's made by the team behind You're Dead to Me. Here's Greg Jenner to tell you more.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, gather round an audio-playing device and give your ears, and indeed your family's ears, a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on BBC Sounds. And if that's not enough history for you, in the new year, You're Dead to Me is back with another brand new series. Thank you. Bye.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that changed exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachi.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.